We have some time for questions. Let me begin by asking this. Do you feel that your university students are more interested in protest music today than a few years ago? How do they express this interest? And how can they be encouraged to explore this music, not only as part of an important American musical tradition, but also as a way of achieving social and political engagement on their part?
Well, university life and young life is atomized today in a way that mirrors the way that much of society is atomized, broken up into a zillion pieces. It's hard for me to, you know, retain my students' attention for more than 15, 20 minutes, and that's not entirely because I'm dull. Our brains are being rewired by our living with devices. I even have mine here, but it's set to a clock. I'm not texting while I'm here. So music no longer has the central role that it had for decades and generations in young life. They're definitely discontented, definitely frustrated, in some cases desperate. Young people are facing a very bleak landscape. They don't have the opportunities that I had and my college, my friends and siblings had when we were young. They're not entering the world that our parents worked hard to make for us. My parents saved so they didn't have to borrow. And my students are graduating with $100,000 in debt and no jobs, or very few jobs. So they're definitely frustrated. They're definitely frustrated by the current political situation, but aren't turning to music as a unifying force because there's no mechanism for music to function as a unifying force the way that it once did. Earlier, I said that if you looked at the country chart in 1952, it was called the Hillbilly Chart. Well, Billboard magazine had, I think, three charts in those days. It had the popular music chart, it had country and music, it had the Hillbilly chart, not that Hillbilly music was not popular, and it had the rhythm and blues chart, and that was it. Now today, Billboard magazine has 15 or 20 pages of charts, countless, literally dozens of genres and subgenres, and that's the way the music is consumed today. So there's a great deal of frustration, discontent, even desperation, but people aren't turning to music for the answer. I'm sorry, but that's the truth. Any other questions?
Yes, I have some more right here. Can you explain the role of rap and hip-hop in protest music?
Yeah. Rap began as a party music, and I was at NYU at the time when a fellow named Rick Rubin was running a record label out of his dorm. I had a girlfriend who had a friend in the dorm who was bringing me cassette tapes. Rick Rubin was producing. He was an early white appropriator of this new black form that was just bubbling up in the Bronx and in Philadelphia and Detroit and other places around the country. It began as a party music, and it's important to think that there's a political dimension even to that, to the right of young, disenfranchised, impoverished people, in this case African Americans, to enjoy life, to celebrate, to have fun, that there's a political dimension to that. And then it became politicized within a few years and began to take on a kind of social realism, evoking the life in the street, often in ways that were graphically violent and portrayed the hedonism in some spheres of life in those days and the rampant violence and the desperation. It told those stories in dramatic terms that outsiders often misunderstood as a glorification or a romanticization or idealization of violence. But the way that that music was heard within the community was not purely as a romanticization or an idealization, but as a portrayal of the world they saw around them. So hip-hop was highly political for a while, is much less political now. It's now a historic form, it's now a highly commercial form, and it's much more engaged in hedonism and conspicuous consumption and misogyny and than it is in politics. But there is certainly a strain, and a fierce strain, of political consciousness and social consciousness in contemporary hip-hop. One of the earliest works of protest against the current administration was a song with the title, this is on the radio. Were you on the radio? Well, there's a verb before the name of the president. I won't say what the verb is, but it's a command form verb of four letters that precedes the name of the president, and it's a hip-hop song.
Could you comment a little bit more on the role of protest in country music? You talked about some early country artists. What about the Dixie Chicks controversy, for example, or Merle Haggard?
Yeah. Okay, the question was, can I discuss the role of protest music in country music? In country music and in early blues, most protests took dramatic form, and the discontent with the oppressive forces of the government and commerce, government institutions, commercial institutions, were expressed in dramatic terms, usually in terms that were specific to the domestic realm, but really had a larger implication. So you'd find lots of songs about abusive men, meaning the people in power are abusing their power. And the songs would be set in the home, in both blues and in country music, where the people in power were out of control, that were really a coded argument against the government and commercial forces. So there's a lot of protest in the songs that we think of as domestic. There's much more protest in country music and in blues than we might at first recognize. Then there is overt protest. You brought up Merle Haggard. He wrote Okie from Muskogee, as you know, which is kind of a right-wing song. He later disavowed it and moved more to the center and then finally to the left of center, and later eventually argued that Okie from Muskogee was intended as a parody. I'm not so sure about that, but there was an evolution in his political consciousness. You know, mainstream country music is awfully jingoistic and conservative. There's Blake Shelton and Kiss My Country, A blank blank. Can I say that on the radio? I don't know. Oh, it's a word for donkey. With waving the song, this talks about having a waving the Confederate flag. It's a litany of jingoistic tropes. And I think we'd still find that kind of vigor for conservative values in country music. And I think it's fair, and not just double talk, to think of that as protest too. Because to those folks, they're protesting what they see as an oppression in the dominant culture. They feel that the world has gone too far and that they're under assault. And this is their expression of protest or dissent with what they see as the oppressive dominant forces in the country. We all have different points of view about all these things. But that music can fairly, I think maybe even best, be understood as music of dissent too.
What do you think the role of the song Alice's Restaurant was in bringing an end to the Vietnam War?
I think it singularly ended the Vietnam War. I think Nixon heard Alice's Restaurant and said, wow, there, yeah, this cannot go on, obviously. Arlo, of course, is Woody Guthrie's son, and it was Arlo Guthrie who brought those two verses that hadn't been performed for decades back into the public sphere. He started singing those verses again. Alice's Restaurant was comical. It spoke to young people, and it spoke specifically to the injustice of the draft. Not so much, wasn't really about geopolitics. It really wasn't about ideology. It was about, oh my God, I'm young, I don't want to die. And that's a message that spoke powerfully to young people. And then that is a big part of what drove young people to protest the war and to unify against the war. My brother was in the Marine Corps. I have an older sibling. I'm a little too young for this, but I love being able to say that I'm too young for anything. That's so great. Can I say that again? I'm a little too young. But my older brother and my cousins and their friends just lived in terror of being drafted. And that's what that song is about. And it played a big part in mobilizing young people to protest the war. And those protests absolutely had an effect on the political sphere. So, yes.
Thank you. Our last question.
Okay.
The role of the artist in the age of Trump. Do you see any protest music today that's rising to the occasion of what's happening politically, both as protest and as art?
Well, there's a great deal of political and social protest music today, and a great deal that's specifically targeted at Trump and his ideology and what Trump represents. As a music critic, I get downloads or CDs every week, and there are several every week. Very powerful music, and Jill's written one of the best and the most effective pieces of music of contemporary protest that you'll hear in the concert after this talk. But as I said earlier, nothing has yet unified. Nothing's yet served as a mechanism of unification in the way that previous songs have, because no music can do that anymore. Can we end with something more positive? I'll do a little tap dance.
Well, you can't see it on radio, though.
Thank you very much. This has been a great thrill.
Thank you.
Maybe I will run for president after. Maybe.
You have been listening to the Monadnock Summer Lyceum on New Hampshire Public Radio. The Monadnock Summer Lyceum presents a weekly series of lectures held at the Unitarian Universalist Church in Peterborough, New Hampshire. For more information about the Lyceum, you can visit our website at monadnocklyceum.org. I'd like to take this opportunity to thank Peterborough Folk Music for their generosity in sponsoring today's talk. Thank you also to Eastview Flowers for the beautiful flowers, and thanks to the Bagel Mill for providing today's reception. We look forward to seeing you next summer. Thank you.